Good afternoon, Your Honors. This is an appeal from a Superior Court entry of judgment after the plaintiff presented her case at trial. Therefore, it's basically a summary judgment decision that's being appealed from. The case revolves around the sale of a piece of residential real estate. The sale process started in July of 1998. My client was acting under a power of attorney for her mother, who had dementia, and she was going to sell the house. She contracted with a Wayne Bartron, who was a Delaware real estate agent, who was at that time working with a company called REMAX. An exclusive listing agreement was signed in July of 1998 with a listed price of $152,000. My client did tell Mr. Bartron that she hoped to make some repairs and clean the house up and get it a little more ready for sale, and so she wasn't in any great hurry to get it sold. The listing agreement itself was for a one-year period. By the end of 1998, in December and early January, Mr. Bartron, the agent, approached a Mr. Pierce, who he knew as a real estate investor and a real estate flipper, and he left a business card at Mr. Pierce's place of business and asked the person he left it with to have Mr. Pierce call him. During the first half of January, Mr. Bartron told my client that she should give up trying to make the repairs, that she wasn't making any progress, and that she should just sell the house. On Wednesday, January 20th of 1999, Mr. Bartron brought Mr. Pierce through the house, and within the next 24 to 48 hours, Mr. Pierce and his partner, Mr. O'Neill, determined that they would make an offer of $96,000 to purchase the house, and that offer was in fact made. My client was verbally told of the offer but did not accept it. Sometime during that Wednesday, Thursday, Friday period, Mr. Pierce also told Mr. Bartron that he would hire him as the selling agent and give him a reduced commission for the eventual sale or flip of this property, and Mr. Bartron accepted that. The basis for that, at least part of the basis, was that my client was reluctant to let anyone in the house without Mr. Bartron being present. I'm sure you're somewhat familiar with real estate, where they put lock boxes on houses, and any realtor can come in with any prospective purchaser and go through the house. My client was very insistent that she didn't want anyone there without Mr. Bartron there, because she still had personal property in the house, and so she was worried about that. The information about the agreement between Pierce O'Neill and Mr. Bartron was contained in handwritten notes that Mr. Bartron would take in a notebook that he kept, and was also confirmed at the trial by Mr. Pierce's testimony. On January 22nd, a Friday, Mr. Bartron, at the request of Mr. Pierce, his new principal, his new person with whom he had a listing agreement, although it was an oral agreement at that point, brought two prospective buyers through the property. The second of the two, Mr. Neerham, ended up making an offer for the property on January 27th, confirmed in writing. The offer was made for $132,000. Again, an as-is offer, and that offer was eventually, that offer was accepted by Pierce O'Neill, and so that contract became effective January 27th. Mr. Bartron went to my client on January 28th, which happened to be the anniversary of the death of her father, went to the house. She had not signed the contract. She had not agreed to sign the contract. It was dramatically less than $152,000, and so she was reluctant to sell it. All of that is contained in testimony at the trial. However, in the evening of January 28th, Mr. Bartron came to the house and, according to my client, pressured her, and she may have used the word forced her, to sign the contract. And it's
Was there any disclosure of the dual representation?
There was not.
Is this something that's permitted under the Delaware Real Estate Commission rules of conduct, or is there anything prohibition on this?
Although outside the record, you can have a dual agency. You can have a dual agency. You can have a buyer and a seller, a broker or an agent representing both, but you have to disclose it.
Was there a listing agreement between your client and Mr. Bartron?
Yes.
Did it not contemplate just such an arrangement?
The listing agreement talked about the possibility of Mr. Bartron being both a listing agent and a selling agent, which he was as to the $96,000. He was both. He was going to get a full commission under that. He wasn't going to have to split it with anybody. But the listing agreement did not contemplate him agreeing to be the listing agent for the subsequent sale of the house while the house hadn't even been sold the first time. It did not contemplate that at all.
Did it bar it?
It did not specifically bar it. The basis of our appeal and the basis of our claim at trial is the implied contract of good faith and fair dealing, which is an implied covenant in all Delaware contracts under a long line of cases.
Let me ask you about that. I understand that's your theory of the case. Isn't this, at heart, an agency law case?
Yes.
And to what extent did the agreement between your client and Mr. Bartron modify the common law of agency?
It was an exclusive agreement between the two of them that he said he was going to sell this house and she could not go to anyone else to try to sell it on her own, nor could she try to sell it on her own, either through an agent or by herself. She had to go through him.
Were the issues of, at common law, what duties an agent owes to the principal while representing the principal ever put in issue before the trial judge?
Yes, they were. I mean,
in what respect?
It was part of the case. It was an agency case. I'm not understanding the question.
Is it correct that under the common law of agency, an agent owes a fiduciary duty of loyalty to the principal?
Yes.
And to always act in the best interest of the principal?
Yes.
Did this listing agreement in any way modify that common law duty of an agent to a principal?
No.
Then why do we reach the so-called implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing?
I'm happy if you decided on that basis. I think that's a fair basis.
Well, I'm not suggesting how it's going to be decided. It's just interesting to me that typically people think of a real estate agent, shockingly, as an agent for a seller or an agent for a buyer or an agent for both, bringing both together when they agree that the agent can act for both a buyer and a seller. And that, you're suggesting to me, I think, or to us in earlier comments, is what this listing agreement contemplated. But it didn't contemplate the factual scenario that you've described.
Correct.
So my only question is, rather than getting into the complexities and the nuances of an implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing, whatever that may mean under Delaware law, in whatever context, why is it any more complicated than an argument that here's an agent who owes a fiduciary duty of loyalty, who breached that fiduciary duty of loyalty in a way that cost his principal the difference between the $132,000 sales price and the $96,000 sales price?
I raised that in my brief, the agency argument, and I do believe that that is a correct analysis.
And that was raised before the trial court?
Yes.
Is it in the complaint, or where is it?
It's in the complaint. And it's in the listing agreement. I mean, the listing agreement basically confirms what agency law is, that it's an exclusive principal-agent relationship.
Well, generally, what the listing agreement does is, as far as the parties wish, it modifies the traditional common law. And that was why my question was, what is there, if anything, in this listing agreement that would reduce or narrow the scope of the duty of loyalty of the agent to the principal under these circumstances?
I think I understand your comment, and that is the only way it modifies it that I understand, as I've read it, is that it allows for the selling agent to collect the full commission if the selling agent finds the buyer. But I think that's the only aspect in which it modifies it.
The only way in which the selling agent would collect less than the full commission would be if some other agent brought the buyer to the seller in any event.
Right, and that's the norm.
Okay.
In the industry. Are there other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chief Justice Steele, Justice Berger, Justice Ridgely, my name is Thomas Seymour Cooney, Esquire, and I'm counsel to Wayne Bartron, who's the appellee in this case. The way we read this case, Ms. Eller is basically saying that by simply agreeing to assist Pearson O'Neill in their sale of the property, that he is violating the covenant of good faith and fair dealing, and we just don't understand how that can be the case. He, in fact, didn't assist Pearson O'Neill in selling the property, even though he had an agreement to do so, and he would have received and did receive a commission for doing so.
Was that disclosed to Ms. Eller?
It was not disclosed to Ms. Eller.
Any particular reason why?
I don't know why, Your Honor. I that really wasn't delved into at the trial level. I don't know the answer why, but I don't think that there's any evidence on this record that it wasn't disclosed for some nefarious reason, that he was trying to hide it from her or anything like that. I think the way this happened, it happened very quickly. The 22nd he got the offer from Pearson O'Neill, he gave it to Ms. Eller, and then the 27th the offer comes in from Nearham to Pearson O'Neill to buy. She signs it on the 28th. I just don't think that people were thinking about it in that sense, and that, in other words, I have to tell her all that this is going on, and I think it happened pretty quickly. This house was on the market for a long, long time. It was very difficult to get it into shape to sell, and I think there was some pressure on Ms. Eller to sell the property, to come up with the money to take care of her mother in the nursing home.
Well, let me interrupt you for a second. Under normal circumstances, if you will, if a person is listing a house for $150,000, just to use round numbers, and gets an offer for $100,000 and says, no, that's too low, and within a week someone else comes along who's willing to pay $135,000, wouldn't it be under normal circumstances that the realtor would say, oh, I've got a better offer for you now, it's $132,000? I mean, isn't that the way one would expect this transaction to have gone forward?
Yes, except, I mean, to apply the hypo here, Wayne Bartron never got that $132,000 offer. That offer went directly from Nearham to Pearson O'Neill, and it's not disputed on the trial record that Mr. Bartron was never aware of that offer from Mr. Nearham to Pearson O'Neill.
Well, couldn't an inference be drawn that the property was, in fact, worth more than $96,000 by virtue of the involvement of Pierce, who was in the business of flipping these properties?
I guess, Your Honor, but I think you would need more than that in order to take this out of a Rule 50 motion.
Well, sure, how about the failure to disclose that circumstance to the owner?
Your Honor, as I recall, it was made clear on the record below that Mrs. Eller was well aware that Pearson O'Neill were investors. Now, I don't think she ever believed, and there was never any testimony or evidence that Wayne Bartron or anybody else told her that these were buyers who intended to live in the house. They were known investors. She had a house that nobody apparently was going to buy in its current condition, and she didn't either have the willingness or the wherewithal or both to put it in saleable shape. So there's nobody else to sell it to.
There's some hint in the record we have, but one could argue it's incomplete, that the rationale for the difference between $96,000 and $132,000 was the fact that Pearson O'Neill were flippers and that they would make substantial improvements to the property in exchange for the $132,000 price. But it's uncertain to what extent, what those improvements cost, or how they may have fit into the $132,000 versus $96,000 numbers. Is there anything that's actually in the record that would explain that difference in price based on what you've just said, that it was being sold for $96,000 as is, it was being sold for $132,000 with a concomitant commitment to fix it up in a certain way? How do those numbers work, or is there anything in the record to suggest they do?
The only number, well, they don't. They don't work dollar for dollar. The concessions, we don't know. The only number that's there is, I think, $7,500 seller's assistance showing up on the settlement sheet. So that's the only hard number that we have. But there was just line items of improvements, and I don't even know that the parties ever even sat down and said the kitchen's worth this and the cleaning is worth that and the painting's worth that and the help with the HVAC is worth that. I don't think that's how these people deal. I think they came up with a number. They came up with some accommodations after settlement. They came up with seller's assistance. There was help with financing. And Mr. Neerham said, that sounds good to me, and so did Pearson O'Neill. I certainly know that Wayne Barchon wasn't privy to any of those things to take that price from the 132, where it was the functional equivalent of 96.
The other thing that confuses me is there was some comment made by your colleague that Mr. Barchon was taking notes of the deal that Pearson O'Neill were working with Neerham, and somehow those notes implicitly meant he knew of the number at some point. Is that so? And if so, at what point he knew of the $132,000?
I don't remember specifically how. I think all the notes reflected was the fact that on the 22nd of January that he made a note that Pearson O'Neill had made an offer for 96. Maybe, I don't know if the number was in there or not, but Pearson O'Neill had made that $96,000 offer, and because Mrs. Eller needed or was requiring Wayne to be present for all showings, and Pearson O'Neill intended to sell it, that he was going to get that commission. That was a quid pro quo, half of a normal commission, a 3.5% commission. That was what Wayne got for his trouble in being available to show the property in connection with Pearson O'Neill's efforts to sell it. But well, that's all I know that the notes say.
Okay, so you would then maintain that the record shows that when Mrs. Eller accepted the $96,000 offer, Bartron had no knowledge that there was a $132,000 agreed price for the flip.
Not only that, Your Honor, he didn't know there was a Joseph Neerham. He let him in, but I don't think he ever knew the person's name. He let him into the house, but the answer to your question is absolutely yes. And then Judge Hurley, he specifically found that too. When my colleague made his presentation in opposition to the motion, that's what Judge Hurley, he pressed him on. What evidence do we have that Wayne Bartron knew any of this when he had your client sign the agreement? And there was none.
What was the trial judge's finding on the issue that your colleague also introduced, which was that his client was forced to accept the $96,000?
I don't think the trial judge ever reached that issue, Your Honor. I don't remember anything specific in the ruling where he made a finding of whether she was forced or not.
Can I go back to review some of the facts, because I'm getting a little confused here. On day one, if you will, Bartron brings a proposed buyer who offers $99,000, right?
Well, it was 96, right?
Okay, 96, I'm sorry. And at the same time that offer is being made, the buyer tells Bartron, I'm going to use you as my listing agent when I flip this property, right?
That's half right.
Okay.
The rest of the sentence was, because Mrs. Eller is only going to let me, meaning the buyer, Pearson O'Neill, sell the property unless you, Wayne, are there. So it's not that there was some deal, you know, under the table that we were going to do this all behind Mrs. Eller's back. The only reason Wayne Bartron was there at all was because they couldn't show the house because Mrs. Eller wouldn't allow them. She still owned the house.
All right, well, I guess that's what I'm trying to ferret out here. If I own the house and I don't want anybody else in there except when my agent is there, right? So I'm making it difficult, I understand. My agent gets an offer, and at the same time that the agent gets the offer, the prospective buyer says, I want you to be my listing agent when I sell this property, and the reason is because the current owner doesn't like to have people running through the property. Doesn't that by definition mean that this property is going to be resold before even the first sale has been consummated?
I would think so. I mean, she had to know that it was going to be resold. I mean,
why?
Because investors were the buyers. She knew that clearly.
Well, the agency relationship between your client and the seller, does it end when there's a contract, or does it continue through settlement?
Oh, it continues to settlement. His obligation is to get her to settlement on that contract. Absolutely. It continues.
What happens as a matter of the common law of agency with the duty of loyalty, which has a subset of a duty of candor? What is his obligation between signing a contract for $96,000 and settlement when in between the two it's being flipped for $132,000?
I suppose that there could be an argument made that the minute he finds out about that, he should tell her.
Right.
And he apparently didn't tell her.
But at that time, she'd already signed a contract committing herself to sell for $96,000.
Correct.
And at the same time, he had already entered into a relationship with the buyers to be their representatives when they in turn flipped it.
That's right, although he had nothing to do with the flip.
Right, but he didn't tell Eller that here's a proposed buyer, and by the way, I'm going to be representing them when they turn around and sell your property.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Wouldn't that be material information?
Well, if he didn't know about it until after she signed the agreement, it would have been interesting information, but I don't think it would have been material because there's nothing she could have done about it. She couldn't go to the Pearson O'Neill and say, oh, I'm withdrawing my offer now. My acceptance now. I don't want to have a contract with you because I found out after I signed it that you guys have sold the property for more money. I don't think she could have done anything with it.
Yeah, and if I think I understand the record in your comments, one of the reasons why would be she knew she was selling it as is. She knew it was difficult to sell at all. And that if it was going to be flipped, it probably would have required an investment from the buyer in order to make the property suitable for a second sale. Is that basically the scenario you would describe?
I think the sale that Mrs. Eller wanted and didn't get isn't a sale that she was willing to participate in. She wanted, as our moms used to say, her cake and eat it too. She wanted a $132,000 purchase price, but she didn't want to do what had to be done to get it. Pearson O'Neill were willing to do it. They were going to help with the kitchen, buy a new kitchen. They were going to clean it up. They were going to supply all kinds of things.
Where is that, you know, the list of the things that the buyer was going to do before they flipped it?
It's in Mr. Neerham's testimony, Your Honor. I don't know if I have his direct testimony and his cross-examination. I don't know if I have those pages flagged.
What about the settlement sheet? Does that reflect anything? And this is what, a couple of days later that all of a sudden they've taken care of all of that?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I missed that last question.
If I understand it, you're kind of trying to justify what happened here by saying that she was only willing to sell the place as is. So somebody, an investor, saw an opportunity and decided to purchase it at a low price and then put some money, invest money into the property so that they could in turn sell it for a higher price. And you're talking about a kitchen and all this other stuff, and all I see is $7,500 in seller's assistance money.
Mr. Nearham testified at trial, the buyer, the second buyer. He testified at trial, but it is cross-examination because he was called by Ms. Eller in the case in chief, the things that they did. And he described doing the kitchen, cleaning it up, supplying paint, helping with, they introduced him to an HVAC contractor that put in an HVAC system out of.
Do we know what day the second contract went to settlement?
They both went the same day. I think it was March 30th, 1999. The settlement for.
So you're saying that the first sale takes place in January 22nd or whatever, and the second sale takes place before the settlement on the first sale, right?
Correct.
And then before either one of those settlements, improvements are made.
I don't know the exact scenario of the improvements. I think that there were some things done, but the bulk of the accommodations, if you will, were after settlement. That's just how these people do things. And apparently they did it. And Mr. Nearham was apparently very happy with how things turned out with his purchase, with the things they said they would do and the accommodations that he received.
And your position would be that Eller got the benefit of the bargain that she agreed to because she was paid $96,000. She wasn't forced to sign the contract. She needed the circumstances under which she would be agreeing to $96,000. And there was nothing that Mr. Bartron could have told her after she signed that $96,000 that would have made any difference in the amount she would have received. Is that fair to say?
I would say that summarizes it well, Your Honor.
But if I'm correct about the dates, it was before she signed that contract that Mr. Bartron entered into a relationship with the buyers of the second buyer.
It was. Well, not formally. It was just when the January 22nd offer came in from Pearson O'Neill to him as the realtor for Ms. Eller, they said, here's an offer. And if you notice in the offer says that they want access to the property to do repairs. I don't think they did too many, but they were given access by way of the contract language. And at that time, all the relationship or the arrangement was, yes, if this thing happens, if she signs it, we will, you know, cut you in on a commission because you're going to allow us access to this property so we can do repairs and show it to people and things like that.
And she was not told about that arrangement before she signed her contract of sale, correct?
Correct. Although I wouldn't characterize it as an arrangement at that time. The arrangement didn't happen until after the contract with Nearham and Pearson O'Neill was actually signed, which was the 27th, I think, of January.
Well, if that is material information, and let's assume it is for purposes of this hypothetical, wouldn't this case have to go to the jury for a breach of the agency-principal relationship?
I don't know what other than I don't know what the duty that would have been breached. I think the duty of candor. I think that means more of you can't misrepresent something material. But if all you're doing is not telling your principal something that doesn't matter in the context of your agency anyway, because it's all over with from the perspective of the sale that you have a contract with, I don't think it becomes a violation of the duty of candor because it just doesn't matter.
I've got a real problem here. I'm looking at the contract between Eller and Pierce/O'Neill, okay?
Yes.
And it is signed by Eller on 1/28/99. And I'm looking at the contract between Neerum and O'Neill Pierce, and it's signed 1/27/99. So before she agreed to sell the property, the realtor had already arranged for, or the buyers had already sold the property again.
That's true, Your Honor, but we're,
so
we're
how
not-
can you say that nobody knew about it at the time she was signing her contract?
I was just saying, Your Honor, that the trial record is absolutely crystal clear on this, that nobody says that Wayne Bartron knew about it. The Pearson O'Neill fellas went out and found this Mr. Neerum all by themselves the day before Wayne Bartron the day before Wayne Bartron had Ms. Eller sign, presented it to her, she signed it. So the key issue is he didn't know of Pierce and O'Neill's sale to Mr. Neerum when he presented that contract to her. He did know that he was going to be asked to help them, the investors, sell it, but that's all he knew. And what Mrs. Eller is complaining about is that she thinks that she's entitled to this Pierce O'Neill sale, the price that Pierce O'Neill got from Mr. Neerum. And I mean, Wayne couldn't have gotten it before the deal was signed because he didn't even know about it. And that's what the trial judge found.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honors, the description of what happened as you've been asking your questions is accurate, that on the 22nd, Pierce O'Neill made an offer. And that's also the day that they told Mr. Bartron, we want to pay you a commission because we need to sell this property and your seller won't let us in except through you, so you need to be working for us. And he said yes.
I don't get that, because to say that I won't let anyone else see the house unless my agent is present doesn't mean my agent has to be your agent.
Correct.
The buyers could come in with an agent of their own. The only requirement is that Bartron be there representing her when they do.
Right. On that Friday, January 22nd, Mr. Marconi says that Mr. Bartron didn't do anything under his new deal for a commission with Pierce O'Neill. But he did. He brought Mr. Pierce in with not one, but two buyers on that Friday, January 22nd. Which was 6 days before my client had ever even signed the $96,000 contract. So he was already working for Pierce O'Neill, showing the house to two prospective buyers. He's already done something which he shouldn't have done under the agency concept. Justice Berger, I think you asked a couple of questions about this. Both contracts were as-is contracts. Now, there was, and Chief Justice, you picked up a little bit of this, and it's sort of not totally clear, but Mr. Neerum, the eventual buyer, was the boyfriend of Mr. Pierce's mother. So he sort of said, yeah, I'll help you out. If you read Mr. Neerum's testimony, though, it's not a situation where they went in and put in a new this and a new that and a new this. It's like, we'll pay for the paint, and Mr. Neerum did the painting. We'll pay for the tile for the bathroom, and Mr. Neerum did the work. So it wasn't like a typical flip where the flipper buys it for 96, puts 20 in, sells it for 132, and makes, you know, 20 grand as a profit. That wasn't this. This was as is, and all that work occurred not under any contractual obligation, but after the two sales occurred on the same day, March 30th, 1999.
Did I hear correctly that the settlement was 1999?
Yes.
And we're here in 2011?
Yes.
And this is not a Dickens novel. How did it take this long?
This is the longest case I've ever been involved with. There were long disputes about insurance coverage because the real estate agency went out of business and went in business with a new agency, and so they all had this fight about whether there was insurance coverage and whether there should have been insurance coverage. So we consolidated for discovery, and then we separated out so they could do summary judgment. But this part of the case couldn't proceed until that. It was exasperating.
Well, has there been one judge involved from the beginning?
Yes.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.